We've come a long way.
We have a virtue card.
Yeah, we've come a long way.
I have a virtue to be critical of.
Right. Oh, I know. But no, we've come a long way. I mean,
by the way, we have our equity roadmap internal survey.
Good morning, everyone. Let's get underway, please. We are launching into the next stage of the process, which is to do these presentations and evaluations with the partnership of our professional staff from the budget office, with the partnership of our director of the Office of Equity and Human Rights, who is back for this favorite part of public policy of his, here with our auditor and with our citizen advisors, including our new member of our citizen advisor panel, Frieda Christopher, one of our new members. Donechka may or may not be here this morning, but she'll be with us along the way. And, oh, come on up, please. You have literally a seat at the table. Donechka Otero Serrano is here as well, and along with our long-term partners on the panel, we appreciate you all very much putting a huge amount of time in with us as the council and collectively as a budget committee to deliberate on a really big part of what the city does. City budgets are how we express our values in real ways, because where you spend the money is what you mean is important. So this is always, to me, a pretty important part of what we do in the course of our business during the year. And so we're glad that you want to help, and welcome to our two new members. We're glad to have you here. So with that, I will turn it over to Andrew to get us launched.
Great. Thank you, Mayor. So we have welcome to the first budget work session. We will have four of them this year, two this week, and two coming up the last week of March. Three coming up the last week of March. Today we're going to talk about a few things. I'm going to give an overview of where we are in terms of the budget situation. I'm going to go pretty quickly through that, but a little bit in terms of the materials, forecast, and what we're going to do during these work sessions. And then we're going to go right into the citywide asset management report, and that may push us a little bit beyond 9:30, but I think we've got some extra time built in for the three bureaus we're going to hear from today. We're going to hear from Portland Parks and Recreation, Portland Bureau of Transportation, and finally the Office of Government Relations. Everyone should have a binder. If you don't, let me know so we can get you that information. And in that binder is a lot of information. They're very unwieldy. This is the time of year where you can see the budget office carrying these around all the time and often dropping them and things spilling out. But what's inside of this is a number of things. There's some summary information, both including a cover memo and some other information about the decision packages that were both requested by bureaus and recommended by CBO. There's a citywide issues tab, which has information about bureau budgets over the last few years, bureau FTE, et cetera. That's also where the citywide infrastructure assets report is going to be. And then we have bureau-by-bureau tabs, and in each one of those, you have both the city budget office review of that bureau's budget, as well as the bureau's presentation materials that they'll be using in their presentation. So if you don't have a seat where you can see the television, any materials they should use, they will use, should be in your binders already. In terms of the overall economic outlook, and council already knows this, but for benefit of the citizen advisors, we did issue a forecast update in February. That forecast update shows that our local economy is still growing very strong, and we have roughly $20 million, a little bit more than a $20 million surplus going into the fiscal year 16-17. And that $20 million rough surplus is broken down into ongoing and one-time funds. It's $4.4 million of ongoing funding and $15.9 million of one-time. Now, those numbers will change before we finish the budget. We will issue a final forecast at the end of April after we see business license taxes. Given current economic trends, we expect the forecast will get a little bit better, probably more one-time funding, and we're not really sure about ongoing funding at this point. And I can't tell you how much more, but unless things change dramatically, we expect to see that improve a little bit as well. Part of the reasons for this, we have very low inflation. Inflation over this last year came in at 0.3%, which is one of the lowest we've seen in years. Our labor contracts have a 1% floor, so that's what we built into the forecast in terms of wage growth, 1% for city employees, but again, it came in at 0.3%. Tax year 2015 overall looks like it's going to be another record year for business license taxes, so that'll be the second record year in a row which, as our economist says, you know, makes any economist who's doing forecasting very nervous. When you see one record, you get nervous. When you see two in a row, you get really nervous about what that means in terms of the long term. But again, revenues are coming in very strong. And as I mentioned, the final forecast will be out in April, and it is likely to show continued improvement. In terms of the overall recommendations that were made by the City Budget Office, in the summary tab, there's a short cover memo that tries to capture just some of the big themes that are in this year's budget and in our budget reviews. And one of the things that I might just draw your attention to, again, around this forecast issue on page 2 of that memo, there's a chart in there that, again, our city economists looked at Big Five general fund revenue over the last 15 years or so. And he broke it down per capita, right? So this is saying if we look at per capita revenue of our Big Five general fund sources, and just to remind people, those are property taxes, business license taxes, utility license taxes, transit lodging, which is our hotel motel tax, and then finally state shared revenues. If you look at those, you'll see that that line sort of bumps around the $450 per capita for most of those 15 years. It drops below sometimes, it goes above sometimes, but it sort of fluctuates around that line. And in the last 2 years, it's shot to well above $500 per capita. So again, as we're going through this budget process, I think it's worth keeping in mind, we don't know where that line's going to go. It is possible that we are in sort of a new era, that Portland, I mean, we're operating very well economically. We're a very desirable place to live. People are moving here from all over the country. People are starting businesses. So it's possible that we've turned a corner and that there's a new, you know, sort of per capita norm that we're going to see. My bet would be that's not the case, that this is an outlier, and that we will revert back to that more historical $450 or so per capita. But that's something we're going to be keeping an eye on as we go forward. And I think the other economic trend to note is that an economic slowdown is going to come. Whether it's going to come in the next 24 months or the next, you know, 4 or 5 years, we don't know. But we are already in a very long expansion, and we will see an economic slowdown. What we hope is that economic slowdown is moderate and can be managed. But that is something that's going to be coming. And so, again, as we go through these budget decisions and talk about sort of the surplus funds, I think keeping those larger trends in mind is important. At a very high level, and we're going to get into the details on each one of these bureaus, so I won't go through them right now, but the City Budget Office, we have recommended allocating out that roughly $20 million surplus to a variety of programs. Housing, we've recommended about $3.7 million of additional one-time resources. Police, we've recommended about $2 million of ongoing ads, but we've also recommended an offset with the school resource officers, which will be a conversation when we get to police. We have recommended adding the 13 firefighters in fire. We've recommended about $600,000 in BOAC for trainee positions to deal with some of their staffing needs. In parks, we've recommended about $3.8 million of ads, but then offset that with about $1.5 million of reductions to help pay for some of those, so a net add ongoing in parks of about $2.2 million. And then in terms of some other things throughout, we've recommended some additional, about $1 million of major maintenance funding for radios. Again, this is a long-term asset need that we're going to need to take care of. We've recommended a $1.4 million ongoing capital set-aside, so this would be in addition to the infrastructure one-time dollars that council has set aside by policy to add a new ongoing set-aside every year to take care of some of those assets. We've also recommended $1.6 million for a levy assessment. This is one of those things that kind of hit the city. It was a little bit of a surprise a couple years ago, but again, we have a levy that we're responsible for. We're not responsible for, but with a joint coalition are responsible for, and we're working with those other governments, but our share of that cost would be about $1.6 million. And then there are a number of smaller adds and reductions as we go through all the different bureaus, and you can see those in the decision package summaries that are in your binder. And I think given where we are going, where we are economically in terms of a very positive place, but where we are going, which, of course, we don't know, but there's always that concern about a downturn, you know, CBO's overall recommendation, both to council and the citizen advisors, is to really add ongoing costs and programs very sparingly. Those per capita tax rates may fall back, the economic slowdown may hit, and all of the ongoing costs that we add today with the surplus today are most likely going to result in some sort of reduction in a future year. And so I think just keeping that in mind, that there are a lot of things we recommended for, but those will likely either need to go away or require an offset somewhere else in the city in some future year, maybe next year, maybe a few years from now. But I think keeping that dynamic in mind is going to be important.
Have you included one of my favorite tables just for getting your head around the scale of the work and where we are, which is your FTE chart over time?
Yeah. In the citywide issues tab, it should be, I think, the fourth chart in that tab, percent change in number of positions going back to 2008-09 to 15-16. So it's in the citywide issues tab.
Okay, there we go.
And there are four tables there.
Yeah, I think that's good. You also have expressed it as a year-by-year table.
So right on the
next page.
Yeah, on the back side.
Yeah. Okay, there it is. Yeah, I think this is just when we think about Frida and I were talking about this earlier. I mean, she's been very familiar with school district budgets. Ours are, of course, different. But in both cases, human resources, people, are a major cost driver. How many police officers, how many firefighters, how many parks employees, and, of course, what we pay them also affects this. But, you know, a big cost of doing business for us is salaries. I mean, yes, we buy asphalt and trucks and police cars and so on, and build bridges and water lines. But there's some merit in seeing what's happened to the city's population over time, what's happened to the workload of these bureaus, and how big is the workforce compared to 5 years ago, 10 years ago. So I particularly find that useful as grounding.
Yeah.
Doesn't necessarily change this year's budget decision that much, but it's good grounding.
And all four of those, we have FTE, and then we also have some of the other charts look at overall discretionary changes, changes in where the general fund budget goes over time as well. Again, trying to give some of that bigger context for grounding.
Andrew, what's the magic of the time frame you've chosen, 8/09?
So there is no magic, and it is important to note because the time frame you use will obviously show, you know, a difference in terms of how you chart it. 08-09 adopted budget was adopted before the recession had a major impact on the city. So it was really fall of 2008 after that budget was adopted. So I think you could see this as a high watermark. And when you look at the total FTEs, you know, 6,035, we still today are about 200 below that mark, which is partially resource related, but I think it's also partially efficiencies. And we've learned how to do certain things better and with fewer resources. But you know, to the extent we kept the same time frame next year, you know, you're starting at a lower point.
Andrew, if I can go back to your chart on page 2. three questions, if you don't know the answers at this point. Is there an optimum number that balances the city's revenue versus the, for better term, stifling of growth? That's the first question. Number two, can you attribute that rise from 450 to 500 to a single item, or is it a mixture of all three? And lastly, if you were to extract the state shared revenue from your total graph, would the trend of the line look the same?
I'll start with the third one. Yes, state shared revenue is a pretty small portion. We do count it in our big five, but I think it's only about $15 million. Yeah, it's about $15 million, you know, compared to property taxes, which are, you know, a couple hundred million. So it's a distant fifth. So yes, I think the trend would stay the same. In terms of the first question, there is no optimum number. I will tell you that budget people, we search for that optimum number, and I talk to a lot of colleagues in other cities, and I think that the answer is it's going to vary place to place. Different cities have different levels of taxation that they're willing to bear. And I think the key question for our city council, but for all the governments, right, schools, county, et cetera, is, you know, where are we in terms of that? And there are a lot of funding measures that are going to go out, you know, over the next couple of years, some from the city, some from the school district, some from other places. And, you know, Portlanders are relatively generous compared to a lot of other jurisdictions in terms of their willingness to pass some of those tax measures. I think what you're seeing here is not necessarily, this is not measure-driven, this is economic-driven, right? And so I guess this gets to your second question, is there a single item? There's not a single item, although business license tax is the main driver. Again, we've gone from roughly $82 million to potentially this year exceeding $110 million. in a very short, 2 to 3 year time period in business license tax. So that's a huge growth. But at the same time, property taxes, as we've come out of the recession, unwinding some of the compression, and seeing that growth, that's also driven that number up. I think I got all three, didn't I? All right. The last thing before we jump into assets that I'll just draw your attention to are the performance dashboards. And what you're going to see for every session are these large, and we've tried to put them on big sheets of paper so they're easy to read and easy to refer to. But every one of these sessions will bring the performance dashboard for the bureaus that you're going to be hearing from that in that particular day. And these are, you're going to have hard copies. These dashboards are also posted online. And the goal here is to give that quick reference in terms of how the Bureau is performing on its key performance measures. And as you'll recall, over the last couple of years, we've worked with bureaus to develop either if they had key performance measures already, just to take those and elevate them and make them more visible, and for bureaus that didn't have key performance measures to develop those and make sure that we're tracking against some of what their key outcomes are. And that is what those KPMs are intended to measure, are the outcomes of what the Bureau's core services are. And these dashboards are intended to provide information, again, to the citizens and council that's really going to guide your decision-making as we go through this process. And specifically today and in these work sessions, guide your decisions on the impacts, guide your thinking about the impacts of budget decisions that we're going to be looking at. And you'll see that what bureaus have done is they've said, here's what we can do with our base budget, and here's what we could do with our requested budget. And so the hope is that we can actually have some real conversation about that in terms of how these budget decisions, whether they're either adds or cuts, are going to impact the Bureau's ability to get things done. And then the other thing you'll see that's new this year is that bureaus have provided long-term strategic targets for every key performance measure that's on these. And so if you look at the detailed charts below, you'll see those targets and what their goals are. And they've tried to align those goals to a city or a bureau strategic plan. So either their own internal strategic plan, or if there's a larger goal in, say, the Portland plan or the comp plan or something along those lines, trying to make sure those things are aligned. With that, are there any questions before we jump into asset management presentation?
Quick tutorial for our budget advisors. Understand that, particularly if you look at that chart where there's this giant growth in percentage for Portland Development Commission and Bureau of Environmental Services, that as we work our way through these budgets, there are multiple layers. Most of PDC's budget is tax increment, but they get a little bit of general fund for economic development functions outside of tax increment districts. BES is mostly funded by ratepayer dollars, but there are some functions that are assigned to BES that can only properly be paid for with the general fund. So these percentage graphs are interesting and helpful, but they're not fully illustrative of what's actually going on in that bureau. In fact, the PDC has shrunk by about 30% in terms of workforce during that time. So actually what the City Council over those years for us, and while I've been here as well, have been sort of making up for the loss of general fund. In BES, this council's been assiduous in making sure that the general fund is paying for things in BES that it should pay for, and that ratepayer dollars were paying for things that they should pay for. And so that's one reason for that growth. So there's policy and politics behind some of these numbers, but there's also this overlapping of how they're funded.
I suspect there's probably something to be explained in every one of these bar charts. Parks reminded me about a levy backfill that put theirs in.
Right.
The Commissioner of Public Affairs seems to be vastly overspending his budget. But there's reasons that his is, that Commissioner Saltzman took on the children's levy and various other things. So there's, I think, a story behind each one of these charts.
I think that's right, and that is always the danger with these high level contextual things. Is there as you both said, there is a lot of detail behind that, and we'll be happy to unpack any of that either here or if we need to go back. If someone has a specific question, we can walk through exactly sort of what happened in those years and explain it. But most of the times, when you see huge jumps or huge decreases, there's some sort of policy decision behind it driving it. Okay, let's jump into the asset management. So in the citywide issues tab. You have behind these charts that the mayor was just referring to, you have the PowerPoint presentation, Citywide Infrastructure and Investment Needs. We'll put that up on the big screen, but you have it in front of you as well. And we're joined today in the audience by a number of both bureau directors and asset managers from our large infrastructure bureaus, so from Water, from the Bureau of Environmental Services, Parks, Bureau of Transportation, and OMF. We were also going to be joined today by Susan Anderson, who was going to jointly do this presentation, but she is ill and was not able to make it today, so she sends her regards. So I will fly solo on this, and I'm going to go pretty quickly through this so we have time for some questions at the end, and then we can move on to some of the bureaus as well. So a lot of these slides are to provide some context. Feel free to stop me at any point if I am going too quickly through them or you have any follow-up questions, but I will try and cruise through this pretty quickly. So in terms of asset management, one of the reasons why we do this session at the beginning of the work sessions is over the next few weeks, you're going to weigh a lot of competing service level decisions for 2016-17, a lot of these budget decisions. And what we're trying to do in this presentation is a couple of things. One, provide evidence of where the city's had success in prioritizing and implementing reinvestment in our capital assets, because I think we really have had success over the last few years, and we are continuing to have that success now, and I think it's worth highlighting that. At the same time, decisions have been made during the recession and afterwards that sometimes preserve current service levels, those on-the-ground, frontline service levels, by allowing our assets to deteriorate. And that's the trade-off as we go through a budget process that's important to keep in mind. And we want to really highlight that trade-off because it does impact the livability. We often focus on preserving those services now because that impacts the livability of current citizens. But by allowing the assets to deteriorate, it affects the livability of our future residents. And so, again, that trade-off is an important one as we have these budget conversations. As we go through today, I'm going to give a brief overview of the 2015 statistics around asset management and talk about our asset management practices in the city of Portland. We're going to talk about how bureaus have incorporated resiliency into their planning process and some options for investing in overall infrastructure.
We just asked to get the slideshow up there.
Great. So in terms of slide three, talking about robust asset management practices in the city, we've made some excellent progress in increasing our asset management capacity both within and across bureaus. I think for a long time we've had some bureaus who are really good at managing their assets and some bureaus who are catching up. And over the last couple of years, there's been a huge amount of information sharing among the professionals in those bureaus. And I think that's beginning to make a real difference. And we're bringing up sort of that asset management ability in all of our bureaus across the city. The City Budget Office also convenes the Citywide Asset Managers Group, so they get together every couple of months to talk through a lot of these issues. And I think, again, we're seeing some of that professional knowledge sharing as well. CBO is continuing to make improvements in our capital set-aside validation process. So also in your binders, behind the summary section, so right behind sort of the cover memo, you'll see, and we're going to talk about it as we go through all the bureaus, there's an infrastructure project ranking summary sheet. What that shows is we got 23 projects submitted by bureaus. We send those through a validation process. The bureaus rank them in terms of their overall risk and likelihood of failure. Asset managers from throughout the city get together to validate those scores, and you can see, again, how they scored overall on a citywide basis on that chart. And we've continued to make improvements, again, relying on the professional expertise that already exists in the bureaus in terms of that overall process. And I think, finally, the thing to mention in terms of asset management practices is council support and attention to the asset management needs over the last few years. It's really translated to some major successes. Again, renewing that one-time capital set-aside, we've seen some positive outcomes from that. Ensuring that parks operations and maintenance, that parks is getting operations and maintenance for new assets, like the Cunnamux Park, which is pictured there on the slide. The parks bond, which went to voters, and potentially other things. The gas tax will have an impact on our ability to maintain transportation infrastructure as well. Overall, asset value in the city on slide four, we have about $34.7 billion of total assets. You can see how that breaks down. Sewer and stormwater is by far the largest at about $13.5 billion. Transportation second at just under $10 billion. Water at about $8 billion. And then followed by our civic assets and parks as well. And what this $37.4 billion represents is the replacement value of city assets. And I think it's really worth noting that this is the result of generations of investments. Some of the assets we're talking about that are counted here are things that were paid for by taxpayers 100 years ago when they set aside parks land or made investments in infrastructure that we may still be using. The next slide, and this is one you see every year, talks about asset condition by bureau. And of that $37 billion, we break that down by bureau, and each bureau then looks at the asset condition and ranks it in terms of very good condition, good, fair, poor, very poor, or to be determined. And the to be determined means they still need some work to figure out exactly where it should rank on there. Looking at 2015, 72% of the city's assets are in fair or better condition, and about 19%, or about a fifth, are in poor or very poor condition. And of that $7 billion, so again, that 19% equates to about $7 billion that are in poor or very poor condition. Of that, approximately $4 billion are in transportation. What we show on the following slide, then, is how that asset condition translates into a funding gap for those bureaus. And so slide six, what it tries to say is, what would be needed to avoid deterioration of our existing assets? And again, the bureaus go through and do this. And looking at transportation, by far, is the largest in terms of the annual funding gap. The other bureaus do estimates as well. $268 million is the current estimate from bureaus in terms of what they need to avoid deterioration of existing assets. Last year, that funding gap was about $242 million. So again, it is climbing. Some of that is deterioration of assets. Some of that's also the way that bureaus are, again, every year they do a little bit better job classifying and figuring out, you know, exactly what condition their assets are in. It's worth noting that $268 million does not include about $130 million in capacity gap. So the capacity gap is what bureaus look at when they say, where are we not providing, where are there existing inequities or deficiencies in service levels for our current customers and citizens? Classic example here that we talk about every year, parks in East Portland. There are fewer of them. There are fewer residents that live within a half mile of a park in East Portland. That's a capacity gap. And again, bureaus estimate that's about $130 million to address that capacity gap. And of that, transportation, again, is a very large share, about $75 million per year for the next 20 years to deal with some of those transportation gaps. I think these numbers are really daunting. And one of the things that, when we've talked about this in past years, we haven't sort of taken that next step to say, what can we do? We look at these numbers, and they're really huge. And I think it's important to note that we can identify, work towards some solutions. One of the things we can do is identify the most cost-effective uses of the maintenance money that we do have. So bureaus do have maintenance funding, even our general fund bureaus do, and really making sure that they're targeting that towards the assets that most need it. And then two, continuing to develop practical mechanisms for setting aside more funding. And we've got those a few slides later on, but council's taken some action. I think there's some additional things we can do to begin to make progress against these, you know, against these large annual funding gaps.
Commissioner Novick, if the gas tax passes, how much will that address the $179 million deficit in transportation?
We're allocating about $8 million a year to street repairs, and another six and a half to safety projects. So I think it's about an $8 million reduction in that amount.
So proportionally, probably about similar to the parks being the only one that shows a positive change from 2014 because of the parks bond. It's about the same, kind of a nice bite out of the need, but not the whole thing.
Well, actually, I'll have Leah confirm this, but I think that we will slow the bleeding, but we won't stop it. So that number, unfortunately, might continue to go up even with that additional money.
On the next few slides, and I'm going to go through these quickly, but they discuss sort of asset management more generally and get into the specifics of some of the asset management practices in our bureaus. We have included this information, again, to make sure that we highlight some of the good work that's going on there. But the goal of asset management overall, it's, you know, to identify cost-effective actions that reduce risk and meet levels of service. And those are the three components that come into play when we're talking about managing Portland's infrastructure. You know, what's the level of service being provided? What's the risk of asset failure? And what's the funding source and availability to deal with some of those issues? An example of level of service on slide 8 is street maintenance. And I think council's pretty familiar with this. What we tried to show here on this slide is the Portland, you know, Bureau of Transportation, they have a goal of maintaining 80% of arterial and collector streets in fair or better condition with no more than 2% in very poor condition. But as we all know, that's not the current state of our streets. Currently, about 55% are in fair or better condition and 45% are in poor or very poor condition. And as I noted, the estimated cost for bringing the streets up to desired service levels is about $74 million a year for the next 10 years. But by setting the goals, transportation's done an important thing and said, you know, we now know what that gap is. And I think if you go back years, 10 or 15 years, you know, we knew there was deteriorated infrastructure, but maybe didn't have that same level of sophistication in terms of exactly where we were and what was needed to get there. And that's why this process every year is hopefully getting some more information along those lines. The next slide, again, council's very familiar with this. It just talks about, obviously a lot cheaper to repair a street in good condition and bring it back up than a street that's in very poor or failed condition.
Hey, Andrew, can I interrupt you for a public service announcement on that point, which is we get calls a lot from people saying, why are you fixing X Street near me when Y Street four blocks away is in worse shape? So we have to explain over and over again that we can't afford to fix all of the streets. You need to spend the limited resources you have, for the most part, preventing streets that are not so bad yet from getting worse.
In terms of one of those criteria when talking about infrastructure assets is assessing the risk. And you know, risk is that combination of two failures. It's the consequence of an asset failure and the likelihood that the asset will fail. The consequences of some asset failures can be relatively minor, maybe a two-hour water shutoff on a residential street. But other consequences can be really significant, even, you know, including loss of life. And then likelihood is exactly what it sounds like. You know, how likely is it? Our bureaus do a really good job of looking at these things, looking at the likelihood, looking at the consequence. And it's those things that show up in the high and extreme risk category that they're going to focus their resources on for the most part. And that's appropriate. Because, again, what asset managers and our bureaus are trying to do is reduce the most risk with those available resources. By actively managing that risk, Portland's bureaus, you know, we strive to maintain, to minimize service interruptions and the effects they're going to have on the community. And then some additional, you know, bureau examples of what's going on in terms of risk assessment. You can see on this slide, in parks, this is a closed asset in Glenwood Park that's awaiting repairs. Obviously that's something we want to avoid. One of the things that Parks is doing is they're beginning a playground condition assessment this spring of 2016 to really look at the risk of aging playground structures around the city and systematically evaluate them and use those to rank their major maintenance investments in coming years. They're going to also include equity impacts into that as a component of that assessment. And underserved neighborhoods are going to receive preference where asset risk status may be the same between two neighborhoods. And again, what that photo shows is a whorl in Glenwood Park that's awaiting repairs and clearly the type of underinvestment that we want to avoid in terms of shutting down those assets. On the right side is a picture of the Portland building. We're actually not talking about Portland building reconstruction here, but we're talking about what facilities is going to do after that reconstruction is done. And they have a new strategic planning and development team that's really, over the next year, is going to formalize an asset management program for those OMF-owned buildings and include a long-term maintenance plan for the Portland building. So, again, we can keep that structure up and maintain that investment we're going to be making over the next few years. In terms of the Bureau of Environmental Services, slide 12 talks about both BES and water, you know, have very mature asset management programs. They invest their capital operating dollars in risk reduction. BES has recently been investing between $40 and $60 million per year in rebuilding and repairing infrastructure to reduce that risk of failure of aging assets. What this image shows are sanitary sewer pipes that have been repaired or rebuilt in the last 5 years. Those show up in red, and in the last 10 years, they show up in orange. And obviously, the work that BES is doing there reduces the risk of sewage releases, road failures, overbroken pipes, and overall service disruptions. Portland Water Bureau has done a really good job incorporating risk management into their overall performance reporting. And they've actually incorporated directly into one of their key performance measures, which is reporting the percent of identified high-risk assets addressed. And you will see that on Water Bureau's dashboard when they present. Water Bureau assesses that risk of failure, you know, on an ongoing basis and assigns each high-risk asset a management plan based on the cost and risk level that was shown on that chart a couple slides ago. And last year, 64% of water's high-level risks were addressed, 27% have planned mitigations, and 9% of risks will be managed as mitigation has been determined as too expensive or not possible. And we really, you know, talking to Water about this, and we really think that Water's use of risk assessment performance reporting could become and really probably should become a model for other bureaus and other infrastructure bureaus that are doing this work. The next couple of slides talk a little bit about resiliency, and we did want to highlight some of the work going on there because our infrastructure bureaus have taken a lot of steps in terms of resiliency planning. And, you know, efforts include projects like Water Bureau's seismic risk study, which we in the planning development directors have gotten a presentation on, and they're doing a lot of really good work in terms of that overall seismic risk. Bureau continuity of operation plans, what to do in the case of emergencies and natural disasters, natural hazard mitigation plan update, and then projects that are implementing actions from the climate change preparation strategy. All of these are focused on resiliency and trying to improve the city's resiliency. And then another example from the Bureau of Environmental Services is how the investments in gray and green infrastructure have improved resiliency and reduced the risks from flooding and landslides. And, you know, we can really see that in terms of a very recent event. Back between December 5th and 12th, we had record-breaking rainfall in the city for December. And those investments in the sewer system and the wastewater treatment plants and green infrastructure reduced the impact on citizens during that storm. Very specifically, the Columbia Boulevard treatment plant treated record-breaking flows and performed well under those extreme conditions. The green infrastructure and floodplain storage along Johnson Creek Basin helped reduce the impacts to home and businesses in that area from Johnson Creek flooding. And finally, quick responses to acid failure, and this was actually Parks, the picture on the right there, in terms of Parks' response to a culvert blowout on Wildwood Trail, again, helped reduce the impact of the overall flooding. So we're seeing the positive impacts of that resiliency planning that our bureaus are doing. In terms of investing overall in infrastructure, we've talked about what bureaus are doing to make those smart and well-prioritized investments, but, you know, more work does need to be done to address those funding gaps. And funding, you know, the infrastructure is critical to maintaining those levels of service over the long term. But again, it's difficult to prioritize maintenance and repair in the face of frontline cuts to services. What we talk about over the next slide when we talk about these solutions, it's important to note it hasn't been a short-term thing that got us here. It's not just the last few years. It's decades, decades of underinvestment in the infrastructure, both because of decisions that were made, but also because of lack of funding and the inability to have the adequate funding needed to invest in that infrastructure. Because it's been so long, it's going to take a long time to get out of this as well. There's no silver bullet. There's nothing we can do to fix that funding gap in the short term. But I think there are steps that we can take over multiple budget cycles that are going to help. And what we have here on slide 17 shows the actions that have already been taken and some suggested actions moving into the future. You asked us a couple years ago to put together a report that outlined some options for funding and allocating resources to major maintenance and replacement. And you may remember this chart from last year and I think the year before. But what we came to you with was a list of things that that we suggested could be done. What you see in green there are the things that already have been done. We did increase the general fund allocation back in 2014, the one-time allocation for major maintenance projects. We continue to pursue new revenues for PBOT with the gas tax. We got a voter-approved parks bond, which, as Commissioner Fritz notes, is helping to reduce some of that gap. Council made policy revisions to reestablish the general fund capital set-aside using one-time dollars, and then also to look at using the PSSRP funding moving forward as well. And we've debt financed fueling station infrastructure improvements, which were needed throughout the city. Talking about what's coming up and some of the options still on the table, we've talked to you before about developing ongoing general fund target adjustments. What this says is to our general fund bureaus in particular, what kind of current appropriation level target adjustments would they need to, again, maintain their existing assets? And Parks has done a lot of work in that area. Some of the other general fund bureaus have started doing that work. Once we know that information, we can come back and put those decisions on the table in front of you so you have something to actually weigh. It's not just we know that there's a lot of money needed. We can actually say, here is the amount needed, and we can start chipping away at that. Increasing the capital set-aside allocation using available PSSRP funding. This is a project that successfully implemented a number of public safety IT projects, technology projects, and there's some ongoing funding from that that council can decide what to do with, but one thing you decide to do is go ahead and put that into a capital set aside. We can also talk about incremental internal service fund rate increases. This would help with some of our, these aren't general fund supported, but these are some of our OMF assets that are underinvested, and asking bureaus to pay more, to pay really the full cost of service for those assets. And then, again, continue and develop those life cycle maintenance investment approaches we're talking about. The gas tax is on there again. And then using those asset management concepts so that the investments we make are the best that we can do. Let me wrap up just by talking about, reminding you again, sort of, talking again about how the steps we've taken, you know, over the last few years. You directed bureaus and the budget office to think about and propose strategies to make progress and address the funding gaps, and you've taken action on several of those. We're continuing to learn from each other. Bureaus are continuing to learn from each other and share those best practices across bureaus to improve that asset management capacity. And finally, we need to adequately fund the major maintenance and repair and do everything we can to start bridging that funding gap to ensure that citizens now continue to experience those assets and use those assets, but also our future residents will be able to experience them as well. And that's going to involve potentially some funding decisions as we go forward. So let me wrap up with that and see if there are any questions. And I'll remind you that all the infrastructure bureaus are here. So if you have specific questions about any of their the information here, they're happy to come up and talk to you as well.
Opening questions on the overview.
Andrew, I have a philosophical question. This is an excellent presentation at a high level. But the one area it sort of gives short shrift is the area that's out of our control, which is the shifting ground on federal and state regulations that impact investment decisions. And I would point to just the, you know, estimated $2 billion in unfunded mandates over the last 15 years that we've done just in the utilities. So to what extent does the regulatory environment complicate what we're trying to do? And the obvious answer is if we're told we have to decommission reservoirs or told we have to do a big pipe or told we have to do a resilience project, obviously that goes to the front of the line. But the consequence of going to the front of the line is that someone else has changed our priorities unless we have the capacity just to indefinitely pass on the cost to our customers, which, of course, we don't. So you want to just comment a little bit about how the regulatory environment complicates this more rational system of asset management?
I'm actually not sure I can say it better than you just did, but I think that that's exactly right. And to the extent that we have to make those investments, it does take away from what we might see. And I think, you know, and I would let the utility bureaus, particularly if they wanted to address it more, if they do their risk assessment and they look at the things they want to take care of, a federal regulatory requirement trumps that. And so, you know, something that they would have rather spent that money on now, has to wait. It falls further behind and potentially presents more risk. The other thing I would note when you talk about that federal impact is the reduction in federal funding that we've seen. And I think that's particularly true in transportation. But, you know, if you go back, you know, 20 or 30 years, a lot of these asset repairs were being paid for with federal funds, and that's not the case any longer. We're having to make up for that locally.
I mean, I'll just use the example that we talk a lot about. We built the big Commissioner Saltzman, Congressman Blumenauer, this council, going back over a long time, we collectively built the big pipe. The big pipe was built to cover 93% of the anticipated problem, meaning it wasn't built assuming there was a 100-year event every year. And the difference in cost was probably a difference between $1.something billion and a factor of that. But again, a lot of that was beyond our control. So the utilities invest a lot of money in doing the big pipe. Laudable goal, we all want to see clean rivers. But to what extent did that bump other infrastructure needs, like replacing pipes? Because there's a point at which you just, you know, you can't keep piling on. So just, it's an interesting question, and we're going to have it with the levies, because we're not sure where the government's going to land on the levies. There's always an ongoing discussion about water quality. We're the only system in the country that has a pass on having to treat our water.
the moment that changes, we're right back, Commissioner Fritz, to having a discussion about UV versus filtration versus other things, big ticket item. So it is an important piece. It's just it's the one we probably control the least.
Should proceed and head into Bureau presentations, Andrew. So our first up is Parks.
Parks.
So Mr. Abate and team, come on up. Good morning. Them to go first? Do you want them to
yeah,
do their presentation
sorry.
First? So go ahead, Mike, and take it away, and then we'll hear from the budget office with their recommendations. So.
Point up.
Okay.
And we have. But I'll start. Good morning, Mayor, Commissioners, members of the Citywide Budget Advisory Committee. My name is Mike Abate. I'm the Director of Portland Parks and Recreation. And it is my great honor and pleasure to kick off the budget presentations this year and for Parks to kick that off. And to express to the council, first and foremost, that the entire Bureau is grateful for your support, your steadfast support over the years, and particularly as the economy's improved over the last several years, you've shown time after time that you believe that Parks and Recreation is a key part of the livability of Portland. And a vibrant park system is one of our hallmarks. So thank you for that. I'm joined today by Jeff Schaefer, who's moving this direction as we speak, and who's our finance manager, and also Judy Bluehorse Skelton, who serves on our Parks Board, but is also the chair of the Parks Board. And I'll talk a little bit more about the role of the Parks Board in the presentation today.
You mean Parks Budget Advisory Committee?
I'm sorry, the Budget Advisory Committee, yes. Also want to thank our senior management team, our own, the extensive Budget Advisory Committee members, and particularly our labor partners, all of whom gave their time and talent to prepare the budget that we submitted. So, let's see, great. You know, though budgets fluctuate every year, the Bureau is guided by some very, very important plans and policies. And so a few of them are shown on the screen. The Parks 2020 Vision, which was adopted in 2001. This is our long-term planning document. And by the way, it's 2016. So that means that in the next couple of years, we'll need to begin another 20 to 30-year look out into the future about what is the future of Portland Parks beyond 2020. We break our long-term plan into incremental strategic plans, and so you see the 2012 to 2015 strategic plan. It provides really specific actions in a short-term period and allows that flexibility to a changing environment. We also produce, and this is an example of the 2014 annual performance report that is a data-driven assessment of our progress towards those goals. And also, I'd like to recognize that these are just the parks plans. We're also intimately involved in citywide major plans, like the Portland Plan, for example, the Comp Plan, the Citywide Equity Initiative, and also the Climate Action Plan. We're key players in that as well. You know, we're a bureau with incredible depth and breadth in our service to Portlanders, 144 developed parks, over 1,500 acres, about 8,000 acres of natural areas, 14 community and art centers, 13 pools, and other assorted facilities, 1.2 million trees, including 230,000 street trees. Our urban forestry group is responsible for those. And 50 community gardens with over 2,000 individual plots around the city. We have the world's the largest forested park in North America. We have the world's smallest park. We have steam locomotives, and we have a motorsports racetrack, just to give a little bit of a perspective on the diversity of facilities. But Portland Parks and Recreation is much more than a number of places, as spectacular as they are. We're really about programs and, most importantly, about the people that we serve. Last year, we provided 35,000 swim lessons, ensuring that young people could be safe in the water. Nearly 320,000 people attended free movies and concerts and summer playgrounds in last summer's Summer Free-for-All. Hundreds of thousands served by our various recreation programs, including our city's youth. In fact, thanks to Council's investment in the teen programming pilot, we saw 2,400 youth passes issued last summer that allowed 2,400 young people to get into our community centers for free, resulting in 1,200 doing activities just at Matt Dishman Community Center alone every single day, 1,200 teens. Many of them were there all day long. Speaking of teens, Parks is the biggest employer of teens and youth in the city. For example, we hire nearly 700 lifeguards every year. Those are tend to be high school and college age students. And last year, nearly 1,000 teens who developed life and work skills in various programs of Portland Parks and Recreation, including the junior lifeguard, the recreation leader, the Eagle golf program, and our grunt and youth conservation crew programs. So we just discussed sort of the breadth of PPNR, but I want to talk a little bit, just take a snapshot about something that's extremely current, and I think this is my opportunity to address the council on a broad variety of issues. I want everyone to know that over the past year, we've been, and actually several years, been thinking about how can we organize ourselves most effectively. And over the past year, our team has been working together to assess our current organizational structure and consider alternatives that will allow us to be more effective moving forward. So effective, actually, it turns out it's today, March 15th, we begin operating under a new organizational structure that you see on the slide before you. The reorg was intentionally designed to be budget neutral. No existing positions have been eliminated nor are required to make this reorganization happen. And it really is designed to accomplish four primary objectives. First, to increase our focus on sustainable landscapes. As I mentioned, we manage over 11,000 acres of land. How can we do that in the most ecologically effective and protected way possible? Number two, how can we provide greater emphasis to our recreation programs, especially for youth? Number three, it will expand our equity and inclusion efforts. And number four, it recognizes the importance of urban forestry as a key part of the services that we deliver to Portlanders. And by the way, for anyone's here, I'm happy to do another briefing and go into more detail on reorg at some point in the future at your convenience. So back to the budget process. As the commissioner mentioned, we had a budget advisory committee, 30 people served on that, 15 members of the Parks Board, 12 members of community organizations, and our three labor reps. We also had our own public budget meeting where over 100 Portlanders participated. We reached out to Hacienda, CDC, and worked with them to host a listening session with many residents in attendance discussing their priorities. And then we tried something new and did a community survey, and over 2,400 Portlanders participated in those community surveys. Out of those meetings, seven fundamental budget values were set as the lens to look through and evaluate as the Bureau developed our budget proposals. You can find all the budget values in that right column on the slide, but I want to call your attention to a few. First of all, just equitable service. Our goal is to provide equitable service in a park system and geography that is historically inequitable. Our drive is to become more fair, more equal, more equitable, build parks and programs in previously underserved areas, and communities that desire to do that, to reach out, creates an inherent budgetary tension with the need to take care of what we have. And if you've heard both sides of those. And the fact is, it isn't choosing between one. It's deciding that we have to do both. So with that tension, of protecting our assets and equitable service delivery, we're always looking to leverage partnerships. That's another budget value. We maximize our ability to provide service through partnerships, investments from donors, sponsors, and grant makers. Importantly, revenue generation is an important part of our budget mix as well. I have these budget values, but I'll also say that as we looked at this year's budget, particularly as we looked at reductions, we recognized, and the Budget Advisory Committee recognized, that we couldn't, we wouldn't be able to hold true to all of those budget values while submitting this budget, but we did try to live within as many of those as possible. So we just discussed the values that guided us, but with 40 budget proposals, we chose to present them to you broken down into key significant issues or theme areas. These issues are providing living wage jobs for valued parks employees, ensuring access for all Portlanders, providing safe places for the public and employees, protecting the public's investments in our park assets, and finally, developing partnerships and collecting fees that maximize the service that we deliver. So the first one, provide living wage jobs, and as Director Scott talked about in his discussion about the budget outlook, this is certainly a big issue for the council and the city. And that's the issue that in this year's budget, we are putting together a package that brings us into compliance with an arbitrator's ruling on seasonal employees performing bargaining unit work. After months of hard work by both labor and management, a settlement agreement was recently approved by council that will cost roughly $4.4 million to maintain current service levels. This shows up in our budget as package PK1. As a result of the settlement, we'll be implementing much clearer distinctions between work done by casual employees and work done by bargaining unit employees. These changes affect recreation work spanning community centers, summer camps, pools, summer free-for-all, our customer service center, inclusion services, and others. It's a big impact. Maintaining our current service level can be accomplished by converting and consolidating work done by, in the past, casual employees into living wage union jobs. And it's going to be about 130 positions is our estimate. If full funding is not available, then we would probably need some type of one-time bridge funding to bridge the timeline to implement a reduced service level. Implementing service reductions in recreation is a fairly complicated matter. Partly, it's complicated by the fact that we put a heavy reliance on program revenue and the tight integration between our basic recreation operations and multiple recreation programs that are supported by those revenues. In other words, a community center like Southwest Community Center, which receives actually very little general fund support, they have a general operating budget for keeping the doors open and the pool and the front desk staffed 105 hours a week. With that foundation of staffing, other classes and programs are able to be provided. But at some smaller sites, it would be challenging to pull out one specific program or reduce hours of operation without compromising the integrity of the entire operation, because each community center is run like a business. A good example of this complexity is the preschool program. While more discreet than any other recreation activities, eliminating preschool as a program would likely trigger the closure of 2 to 3 community centers that are anchored by their preschool programs. And until this arbitrator's ruling, our preschool programs have been self-sufficient. They've covered their own costs. So, for example, Selwood Community Center and Hillside Community Centers depend to a great deal on those preschool programs. It's also worth noting that our preschool programs are greatly appreciated by hundreds of Portland families. They have indirect benefits, including activation of our community centers during off-peak hours when we have capacity. And they fill a gap between Head Start programs and more expensive for-profit preschools. Under the scenario in which council funds full ongoing funding of this arbitration package, the $4.4 million,